We have been in the series on the book of Acts since January 4th, and we are down to the final two. We've got two messages left in the series, and so I'm excited to bring this to its exciting, dramatic conclusion. But as we start out, I want to tell you a little story, something that happened about 10 years ago or so. If anyone's ever been, anyone in here ever been on a missions trip overseas, like gone somewhere, paid, okay, raised support, done all that? Okay, so those of you that have been on one, has anyone ever put one together and led one? Has anyone done that? Okay, that's, I've been on missions trips and stuff before, and then when it was my turn to lead one, just the amount of administration and details and things that go into it, it's pretty crazy, especially for students. When you're talking about permission slips and international flights and passport, it's just unbelievable. So we really felt called to do a missions trip over to London, England in 2003. And so I partnered with another church. My brother-in-law, Tim Holdridge, was a youth pastor in Ohio at the time. So the two of us put our groups together and brought 35 as our group. So 35, all the flights and connections and customs, and just imagine all the details and the ministry that we were going to do, because typically that's an expensive trip if you have to stay in a hotel or do something. So we had a contact in our youth group. One of my youth leaders had a great friend in England that had opened the door for us to actually take our teens into public schools all throughout England and present the gospel and do music and do all kinds of different stuff. And so we were very excited about this opportunity. Also, this guy had provided us with host homes. And so we had sort of broken everyone into groups for these host homes. And so about 3 weeks before we were getting ready to go, I was getting coffee with this guy and my friend from my youth group that was sort of in charge of those details. And I sat down with him. We were talking about life and how everything's going. And about halfway into the conversation, I'm like, "So, man, how are you doing? Like, how are you feeling? What's going on with you? You know, like how you been?" He's like, "Oh, I'm a little discouraged. Like, I'm not really sure. I'm not really doing so well. I'm a little bummed." I'm like, "Why? What's going on?" He said, "Well," he said, "Yeah, I talked to my friend in England and you know, everything kind of fell through, and I'm just kind of bummed about it." I'm like, "Well, what fell through? Like, your trip to the IHOP with him or something you were planning? Like, what actually fell through?" He's like, "No, everything fell through. Where we're going to do our ministry, where you're going to stay, all of your host homes, everything is gone. Like, nothing can work. He can't be there. There's a conflict with his job, and he can't do it." At this point, we had invested $50,000 in 35 airline tickets and everything. I mean, this was all non-refundable. Like, we were going. And he said this to me, and I just about, like, I think my hair, you know, those of you who saw Inside Out, remember Anger's hair lit on fire? You know, just kind of went, I'm pretty sure that happened to me. I got very red and shoo, like, "What are you saying? What are you talking about? Like, there's nothing we could do." "No, there's nothing we could do. It's done." So I'm really bummed about it. I'm like, "Yeah, you're bummed about it. Like, I'm going to strangle you. Like, what are you doing? This is awful. Like, this is incredible." So I called. I'm like, "Okay, well, I'll talk to you later. We'll figure something out." So I called my friend, Scott, who was sort of my right-hand man. It came over and we talked about, like, what can we do? And so we sent an email out to a church in that area that was pretty well known and just said, "Hey, can we come and serve you for 2 weeks and got all this time to fill and all these people and man hours?" And they emailed us back and said, "Actually, we've never allowed a U.S. church to come over and help us, but we do have a need, so we'd love to have you come. And we can't help you with anywhere to stay, but we can recommend hotels." And I'm just sitting there like just running a little math, you know, a little adding machine in my brain, like, how is this all going to happen? How is this going to work out? So I'm on the phone. I booked this Holiday Inn at King's Cross for us to stay in with gave us a conference room in the basement every night so we can have, like, team meetings and have worship times and stuff. So we get there. We get to England, and we get off the plane, and we get to our stop off of the tube because we're going to take the subway, you know, the underground, they call it, or the tube. We're going to take that everywhere throughout England. That was going to be our transportation. So we get off of that, and we're walking to the hotel, which they said was just a few blocks away, and we realize it was 2 actual miles, not 2 kilometers, not 2 blocks, 2 literal miles. And so we're walking with all of our stuff, and we had a band. Our guys were in a band, and there was, like, bringing keyboards and amps and guitar cases, and Angela was in a wheelchair at the time, so I'm pushing Angela, and I've got our own suitcase, and someone's child was on my back, and I'm just kind of working my way through, and our group was fading fast. I mean, 2 miles, like, I mean, those of you who are runners, that's, like, nothing, but for the rest of us, 2 miles is, I get tired driving 2 miles. Anyway, so we're like, how are we going to, and then this girl who's like 15 years old just gets like halfway and she just stops and like drops her stuff and she's like, I just can't go any further. I'm so tired. And we're like, we're all dying here. You know, let us serve you, Queen of Sheba. You know, so we grab her stuff. And I think someone picked her up as well. And we just kind of kept on walking. So we get to the hotel. And I talked to Scott. I'm like, we cannot do this every day for 2 weeks. We're going to die. We can't make it happen. And so he arranged a charter bus. And we got transportation back and forth all for our time there. But that was not the plan. We had spent time praying. I had sought good counsel, made strong plans. Everything was airtight about this trip until 3 weeks before, when the rug was completely pulled out from under us. Everything that we did was right. So now we are in a country that we shouldn't be in, because we should probably not be taking this trip. Spending a lot of money we really didn't have. Staying at a hotel that we shouldn't be staying in based on its proximity to where we need to go. And yet, God had a purpose in it that we couldn't see. In Acts chapter 27, we have Paul, who we've been walking through a lot of his life. And here's Paul. He's just appealed to stand before Caesar. And so they say, to Caesar you will go. And so in Acts chapter 27, if you want to turn there, that's where we're going to be today. Paul is going to take a ship as a prisoner from where they are, all the way from Caesarea, all the way to Rome. This is his journey. This is his path, because he needs to stand before Caesar. And remember, Jesus had stood before him when he was sitting in jail in Jerusalem and said, "Take heart, be encouraged. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you will testify about me in Rome. Don't be afraid. You're going to get to Rome." So Paul, in his mind, is just focused. I'm getting to Rome. That's what God has for me. That's what God's calling is for me. That's the end of my life. That's how this is all going to end. I'm going to bring the gospel to Caesar himself. I want to talk about a lofty goal. That's like someone being like, "Well, God told me last night I'm going to stand in front of the President of the United States in the Oval Office and present the gospel to him. I'm going to stand in front of a famous world leader. That's where I'm going to go, and that's where my life is headed." Talk about a giant impact. So that's what Paul was about. That's where he was heading. And so in Acts chapter 27, we have the story of his journey to Rome by ship. Acts 27, verse 1. "And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon," verse 3, "and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Haven, near which was the city of Lycia." So central New York is making some appearances here in the book of Acts. In chapter 28, they go to a place called Syracuse as well. And in a few moments here, they're going to be in Phoenix. So just know there's relevance here. You know, this is a central New Yorker's favorite passage. Okay. So here we are. So verse 9, Paul is going to say something to these guys. Verse 9 says, "Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, 'Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives.' But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul had said." So we'll pause there. Let's remember for a moment. So Paul's in verse 9 saying, listen, it's past the fast. And this day of the fast was the Day of Atonement. And they've kept meticulous records, and this was AD 59. So they believe that this, the day of the fast, the Day of Atonement in AD 59, was October 5th, 59. That was it. And so nobody sailed between November and February. That was like the bad season. That was hurricane season. That was monsoon season, typhoon season. That was, you do not want to be out on the seas during that time. That was like the winter. That was when nobody was sailing. And so to start a great voyage just before November was not smart at all. And so Paul stands up. And what condition is Paul in this story? Is he a free man who's booked passage on a ship to go on a tour somewhere? No, he's a prisoner. So he's in chains and he's got guard around him. And he stands up and says, everybody listen to me. It's a bad idea. Let's not go. Trust me. So there's no surprise the centurion says paid more attention to the pilot and the captain and the sailors than he did to Paul. So you look at this, you're like, why would Paul speak up? What possible motivation or credibility could Paul have in this moment to say something like this? Well, 4 years earlier, he had written about his suffering for Jesus. And among that, he said, 5 times I have received 40 lashes minus one from the Jews, and 3 times I have been shipwrecked. He had already been in 3 different shipwrecks. Now, if he was the one driving, I'd say take away his license and check his vision. Or something, but he wasn't driving. He was in 3 different shipwrecks. In fact, he says, and for one of those 3, he says, I spent a night and a day in open sea. Now, for me, that makes me extremely anxious and nervous. That's my ultimate fear, is that moment where you're just kind of treading water in the ocean, just waiting for some great white to just, I mean, there's even biblical precedent. I mean, Jonah was in the open sea, and we know what happened to him. So, you know, something comes up, and even though God delivered Jonah where he needed to be, I don't know if that still is happening these days, you know. So he knew what he was talking about. 3 times he'd been shipwrecked. He's saying, I know what's going on. Look at the wind. Look at the time of year. I'm not kidding. But they ignored him. And they decided to go anyway. Verse 12, and because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So the majority ruled. They said, we're going to go and keep on rolling. Verse 13, now when the south wind blew gently, supposing they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. Don't you love that? One second there in verse 13, it says, supposing they had obtained their purpose. They had obtained their purpose, but God's purpose for these poor sailors on this 3-hour tour, no, longer than that, these sailors that were going, God's purpose that they had obtained was much different than what their original intention and purpose was. Their purpose was to make it to Phoenix for the winter, maybe try to scoot up and get to Rome before the bad weather gets in. So they're thinking, hey, the gods are shining upon us. You know, they were polytheistic, believed in all kinds of false gods. They're thinking, hey, Ariel the mermaid is going to help us get there in one piece. You know, we've got the favor of all of the Disney water-based creatures. Let's just head out. And so they started out. Verse 14 says, but soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeaster struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, verse 18, they began the next day to jettison the cargo, and on the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither the sun nor the stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Okay, so just put yourself on the ship now. These guys are real sailors. This is a cargo freighter from Alexandria, so it would have been something that would be bringing grain to Italy. They considered Egypt and Alexandria to be sort of the supplier of the food for the Roman Empire. So this boat, part of the reason why they wanted to go was that they don't get paid until the stuff gets dropped off. So there was an incentive to get the, and then the soldiers just wanted to get rid of these prisoners and get back to their family. So there's a lot of different motivations for going, but they set out this horrible, the Greek word there for that wind was typhonic. It was a typhoon type of a storm, 100 plus mile an hour winds blowing this thing. They drop the anchor. Some commentators say they even dropped the main sails into the water. Anything they could do to slow this push that they were getting, they could not control it. Day two, they got rid of all the food, all the cargo, all the precious cargo, the reason for their journey to sell that, they chucked it all overboard. Day three, they got rid of all their tackle and a lot of the gear they would have needed. And it's interesting because they mention they couldn't see the stars or the sun for many days, and you're thinking, wow, that's discouraging. If you've ever been on a cruise ship and you'd like to go out at night and walk on the deck and see the beautiful stars and wow, what a great thing. And during the day, you want to lay out and get a sun. That's not the reason that this mattered back then. They didn't have GPS. They didn't have all the fancy fish finders and nautical gear. They navigated their route by the stars and by the sun. So if you can't see your main method of navigation, how in the world do you know where you're going? They had no way of knowing where they're going. Now, if you've ever been, I've not spent a ton of time on like large boats. I mean, I lived on a lake, and so kind of the small boat thing, but it never got too bumpy to get nervous about it. Never got seasick or anything. But if you've ever been on a plane, and they do the boom, boom, please fasten your seatbelt. We're entering some turbulence. And you got kind of like the, you're going up and down like, I mean, even, you know, I don't really have any fear up there, but boy, there have been a few moments where I've been a little bit white knuckling and I've kind of made peace with God and kind of said, this is how I go. Maybe, you know, just maybe I could talk to the person next to me about Jesus. Something powerful could happen if this is it, because, you know, we're kind of doing. And then all of a sudden it's like, it just stops. And it's like, if you had a button that said stop the turbulence, why didn't you push it 45 minutes ago? You know what I mean? So it's almost just like you steady out. But like, if you've been in a season like that where you're like, oh, the flight was awful. It was like an hour of turbulence. And you're like, oh, I'm just so scared and just hurting. Imagine two straight weeks of a ship being battered and beaten in hurricane force winds, driven against where it wanted to go, totally out of control. You couldn't see, it was totally nonstop rain and wind and waves up and down and up and down and up and down. How are you gonna eat? How are you gonna sleep? At some point you run out of the ability to do this. And then you're still doing this, but nothing's there and that's worse. These guys were in bad shape. They get rid of the cargo. They get rid of the tackle. This is awful. I mean, this is desperation. These are not rookie sailors. This is not five guys on a wakeboard boat driving across Lake Ontario, getting caught in a storm, not knowing what to do. This is a real deal crew of sailors that knew what they were doing, and they were all, it said in verse 20, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Now notice who is among them who lost hope. Because we know that Paul, Luke, is writing a first-hand account. Luke, the doctor, wrote the book of Acts. He's with Paul on this boat. And Aristarchus. So we at least have three people believed in Jesus Christ are doing this. And yet it said, all hope of our being saved was abandoned. Meaning Luke and Paul and Aristarchus and the soldiers and the sailors and everybody on the boat lost hope. This is a desperate moment. In the middle of that desperation, look at verse 21, Paul stands up. Since they've been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not set sail from Crete and incurred this injury or loss. Isn't that a great way to open your speech? I told you so. That's awesome. Thanks, man. Could someone just stab him or throw him overboard? Wow, that's the last thing we needed to hear from you. So why would he say that? He knew that he was right. He's saying it to say, listen, I predicted this would happen and you didn't listen. Don't ignore me again. I'm telling you what we need to do, and last time you ignored me, and this is where we are. This time, listen to me. 22. Yet now I urge you, take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. You got to wonder, the ship's owner's got to be like, oh, man. man. You know, like everyone's like cheering, yay. And he's like, man, that's an expensive boat. Verse 23, for this very night there stood before me an angel of the God whom I belong, to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island. I love this. So Paul had lost hope. Luke, Aristarchus, the sailors, the soldiers, everyone, all 276 men that were on this boat had lost hope completely. So much so that God had to dispatch an angel to Paul to say, Paul, take heart. Come on, Paul, don't be afraid. You're going to stand before Caesar. That's still the ultimate goal. In fact, no one's going to lose their life. Paul hears this, and he stands up in front of the men and says, be encouraged. No one's going to die. My God told me. But we've got to get off of this open sea. Verse 27, when the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. I think sometimes we read a passage like that and it sounds so civilized and organized. Like they're quietly letting down this boat. Don't worry about us. We're just working on the anchors, you know, and Paul sees everything at this point. Here's the prisoner that's somehow calling the shots for all 276 men, including Roman centurions and captains. And he says, wait. He whispers to the centurion, hey, if these guys go, you're going to die. Don't let them leave. And so the soldiers come over to the one lifeboat that they've got, that they've secured, that somehow hung on through this whole thing. And the soldiers take out their swords and cut the lifeboat out and push it out to sea. Do you think that this happened peacefully? Do you think that this wasn't a desperate, angry, bloody struggle as the guys that are sailors are trying to get it down and the soldiers are trying to cut it? I mean, this was a desperate, violent, intense time. Don't allow the space of history and the fact that we're sitting in an air-conditioned space take away the desperation of this moment. The sailors were trying to get out of there and leave everyone else to die. Verse 33, and as the day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now when it was day, verse 39, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. Can you imagine if the sailors had left on that lifeboat? What would the poor soldiers and Paul and the prisoners have done to do this expert navigation that they were doing? Paul knew we need the sailors if we're going to make it, and this is proving why. They struck a reef and they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, verse 42, lest any should swim away and escape. I love that. So they haven't eaten in 14 days. And these prisoners that are chained are somehow going to develop a Michael Phelpsian strength to just swim away back out to the open ocean and escape. So, I mean, there's a little bit of delirium going on here, but the soldiers are like, why take a chance? We have a total out. All the prisoners drowned in the shipwreck. Let's just kill them and save ourselves a lot of trouble. Because remember, if one of these soldiers escaped, or if one of these prisoners escaped, the soldiers would face their fate, which was typically execution. So they're like, you know what? Let's just save time. We'll blame it on the shipwreck. Let's just kill them all. But the centurion, verse 43, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to the land. So in this moment, you got some people kind of hanging on to pieces of the boat. You know, my mind runs to Jack and Rose, and she's holding on to the door, and he's holding on in the water, and she just doesn't even think to let him up on that door with her. She just shoves him off into the deep. Sorry. I've never quite understood that part of the story, but I'm sure it was necessary. I don't know if you've been bothered by that scene. Anyway, so they're holding on to pieces of the boat. Those who can't swim get in there. Those who can swim get there, and they all make it onto the beach. Imagine that moment. 14 days had to feel like months. I mean, days when you're in your house and you're doing your routine, time can go by fast. But if you've ever been somewhere that's out of your comfort zone where something bad happens, the days seem to last a little bit longer. And I'm sure this little block of 14 days did not run. They didn't get done and be like, wow, 2 weeks just flew by while we were puking nonstop and totally thinking we were going to die. You know, so they get on the beach and imagine what it was like to see the shore and to just lay on their faces and roll around. And I'm thinking about Paul. He had stepped up to become a leader in this moment. And if ever there was a time in Paul's life where he could just say, oh, I'm going to take a break. I'm just going to go over here and sit on the shore and relax, and maybe there's a blanket. I don't care. I just am so glad I'm done heaving or whatever he was doing. But it's amazing. Paul didn't stop. He didn't stop and take a rest. Look what he did. Acts 28, verse 1. After we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and welcomed us all because it had begun to rain and was cold. So, seriously though, after everything they went through, could they possibly have some sunshine and some warmth? So it's like they just survived a shipwreck, now they get off, now it's raining again and it's freezing cold and they're stuck on the shore. And so here's verse 3. What's Paul doing after this ordeal? When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. I mean, is there anyone else? I mean, that's not funny because I feel bad for Paul and I don't want to mock him just in case this happens if I ever try and build a fire. But I think about this moment. So he just survives a shipwreck. He's on the shore. It's cold. It's rainy. And Paul could be laying there like, God, thank you for getting me here safely. Instead, Paul is that guy who is still serving others. He's helping. He sees that you're cold. He sees you're hurting. Well, let me go get some wood for the fire. And he comes, and as he's putting wood on the fire after surviving a shipwreck, he's bit by a poisonous viper. A poisonous snake comes leaping out of the flames. Now, for those of you that have built some bonfires, I've built a few fires in my day. A few. I've never had this experience. Has anyone else had a snake leap out of the fire and bite them on the wrist? I hope not. Some yes, okay, that's good. You're still here, that's good. Or maybe that empty seat, that's what happened. Sorry, buddy. No, I don't know. So this thing leaps out, bites him. It's like, you got to be kidding me, the poor guy. What else can he endure? He's lived through a shipwreck. Now he's bit by a snake. So look what happens. Verse 4. It says, when the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, no doubt, this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live. They worshipped a deity on Malta named Justice, who was believed to be the daughter of Zeus, and she was literally the person who enforced justice, was the one who said, Dad, this guy's a murderer, make sure he dies, and Zeus would enact the punishment. So they worshipped her, and they believed that this was her way of not allowing this guy to get away with murder. Verse 5, he, however, Paul, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. So imagine you just got bit by a snake. There's all these people around looking at you, and now they're just sitting here staring at you, waiting for Trent to swell up and die. And there's a whole crowd just waiting. They're taking bets on how long it's going to take or how big his head's going to swell or talking about their cousin Eddie and what happened to him when he was bit by the viper. Like, this is just an awkward scene, and they're all standing around waiting, and look what happened. It says, they were waiting, but then when they saw no misfortune had come to him after waiting a long time, they changed their minds and said he was a god. Now, it's interesting. Whenever this happens in the book of Acts, usually something bad happens after that. If someone says you're a god and you don't refute it, Herod Agrippa died eaten by worms because he didn't refute it. But here's what's interesting is that it doesn't say that they worshiped him as a god. It just says that they, in their minds, were like, oh, he must be a god. And Paul maybe wasn't aware of what they were saying. So even though Paul didn't publicly refute this to them, there's no evidence that he needed to because they weren't taking the next step of worship. Verse 7. Now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island, or like the mayor or the governor of Malta, named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery. And Paul visited him and prayed. And putting his hands on him, he healed him. And when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. They also honored us greatly, and when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. Okay. So Paul is on a boat that is heading to Phoenix and to Rome, and this is what he believed was next for his life. This was his plan. This was his purpose. This is what God had told him was coming next. This is where his focus was. He was single-minded heading in that direction. And as he's going, a storm comes in so violent that it shoves him completely out of the way. They have no idea where they are. And for 2 straight weeks, with hurricane-force winds, they are shoved and jostled and rocked and rolled and shoved. And finally, their boat is obliterated. This is a photo taken on the day of the shipwreck. No, I'm just kidding. This is not a photo of that. But that's the idea. The ship was just torn to pieces, crashed on the rocks away from the shore. Paul had lost hope in the middle of the storm. Why? Because he had placed his hope in a vessel that was carrying him to the plan that he thought God had for his life. He had put his hope not in God, but in his ability to get to what God had for him. He put his hope not in God's ability to protect and trust him. He put his hope in the ship. And so when the ship looked like it was going to sink, he lost his hope, it said, to the point where an angel had to say, Paul, it's going to happen. Hang in there. Trust me. Have faith in what God's going to do. What I think is interesting is if you think about the story of Jonah, God told Jonah to go do something, clearly. And Jonah said, no, I'm going to get on a boat, and even though Nineveh is that way, I'm going to go that way to the very end of the earth. And what does God send to stop him? A storm. A very violent storm. So violent that career sailors were praying to whatever god they could think of to get this thing to stop. And finally, Jonah himself was sacrificed into the sea to get the storm to stop. God sent a storm in Jonah's life because he was being disobedient to God's plan for his life. But look at Paul. Paul wasn't being disobedient. God said, Paul, you're going to stand before Rome. And Paul said, I'm good. That's good. Let's go. He got on the ship. He's pushing. He's going. He's on his way. And yet God still sends a storm. So it's not the presence of the storm that indicates whether or not you are being obedient or disobedient. It's not about the storm. It's about God using the storm to push us into his purpose and his plan, which is far bigger than our own. Just because a storm has entered your life doesn't mean that you aren't following God. Just because suffering has come in and you think that God has told you, you've sought wise counsel, you've got a plan, you've prayed about it, you have peace about it, and you said, this is where we're going. You've got your wife, you've got your kids, you've got your family, you've got your plan, you're all ready to go. This is where we're heading. And you take a few steps and you are just blindsided by a storm. Everything changes. Stuff you cannot control, stuff you cannot stop. You can't change it, you can't fix it, you can't remove it. You are completely helpless by the storm that is being pushing you, and all of a sudden you find yourself stuck somewhere else, and you look around and there you are, standing on the shore of somewhere you did not plan on being. And so you have a decision to make when you're standing right there. Do I stay here and stare at the wreckage of my old plan? Do I stay here and wait for another boat to come in and take me where I want to go? Do I sit here and fold my arms and wait for God to send me another ride? Or do I turn around and enter the city in the place that God has placed me right now? That's what I love about Paul. What does Paul do? As soon as he gets there, he serves. He makes the fire. And then what does he do? The governor's dad is sick. Paul goes to him and ministers to him and prays for him and heals him. And then, you want to talk about someone who was tired. They make this sound like this happened very early in his arrival. I don't know how many days you need to recover from a journey like that, but I would think it's more than he had. And the whole town shows up. Everyone who's sick, everyone who's lame, everyone who's hurting. There's a line out the door all the way down the island, and Paul engages with the people that are right in front of him. Because God loved those people enough to send a storm that pushed Paul exactly to their doorstep. And here's what's amazing. They had no idea where they were going. They couldn't get there. They had no clue where they were at. Even if God had told them, you're going to Malta, they wouldn't have been able to get there with navigation. But based on the time of year, the nautical records, the tides, the speed of the winds, and the distance from Fair Havens to Malta, 476 miles, in order to make that journey by boat in 2 weeks, the journey was a perfectly straight line. How is that possible in the midst of a storm that is chaos, winds that are swirling and spinning you, you're going sideways? The point is that God sent a storm that was directly placing Paul on the doorstep of the Maltese people and all of their little white yipping dogs. He put them right there. That was God's plan for Paul, and God's plan for us is always bigger than ours. Paul's like, God, I want to go to Rome. I want to go to Rome. And God says, you're going to get there, Paul. Hang in there. He sends an angel. You're going to stand before the emperor. But first, I've got something for you to do. Will you engage where God has placed you right now? For some of you, you're like, how in the world did I get here? This wasn't the job that I wanted. This wasn't the life I wanted. This isn't the place we're supposed to be living. I was headlong on a full different direction, and I was moving straight ahead, and a storm came in and knocked me off course, and here I am. So maybe you find yourself standing on that spot, staring at the wreckage of your life, going, how in the world did I get here? God, send me another boat. God, send me to where I want to be. I don't want to be here anymore. Send me somewhere else. This is not the job that I wanted. These are not the people I want to be around. These are not the friends I want to have. This is not the life I want to lead. God, why am I here? I'm stuck on the shore of Malta. And God is saying, turn around, because I love the people of Malta so much that I've sent you to them. And if you don't engage, Paul, you're going to miss out on what I have for you. And what I have for you is to be part of my plan to heal and to bring the gospel to people that I love. Sometimes God sends a storm, not because we're on the wrong path, but because he's got a bigger plan than we had. And where he sends us is where he wants you to engage. It's amazing because one night when we were in England, we're in this hotel that we weren't supposed to be in, doing a trip that was completely pulled together at the last second because of those other changes, because of a horrible storm of administrative nightmares. And one night we were in there in the basement after a day of ministry and we were singing. We just had a time of worship. And these are high schoolers and they're singing out to God and just passionately worshiping him. And some were so moved by what God was doing in their heart, so moved by what God was doing in their life, that in that place, in that moment, there were some that were on their knees, their arms were stretched, and they were crying out to God, literally crying. And in that moment, I saw the doors to the little conference room kind of swing open a little bit. And of course, me being the person that I am, I was like, who is that? I'm looking over, and I see little kids. I'm like, get them out of here. Get them out. It's typically how I react to other people's children. Get these kids out of here. What are they doing here? And they kept coming in. Some of our people went out in the hall with them to talk to these little boys, little British boys, little Harry Potter and his friend, whatever the names are. And they're like, Cliff, you got to come out here and talk to this kid. He's got a lot of real questions about God. Of course, I'm like, oh, come on, if anything else happens on this trip. So I go out into the hallway, and I'm talking to him, and he looks up at me, and he goes, why were they crying? Why were they all crying and on the knees? What's going on in there? Who are they singing to? That's all I've got, British-wise, okay? So don't question it. Don't ask me to repeat it. It quickly becomes Russian and then Spanish and then, like, Minnesotan, and it's gone. So that was it. I had one shot. So he says this to me, I look at him, and so I'm explaining to him that they love Jesus and that he's brought us here and we're learning and we're growing and this is what Jesus has done in our life. And he kept asking me question after question in our little group there, and we got into all this stuff about the gospel, and all of a sudden after about 10, 15 minutes, he just said, well, I want to do this. I want to be a Christian too. This little 11-year-old boy named Thomas kneeled down right there outside of a conference room in a hotel we weren't supposed to be in a city that with a trip that made no sense now. All the details that we had arranged had fallen through, but yet God had it in mind before the foundation of the world that he was going to save this little boy in the midst of all of these circumstances. God loved him that much to inconvenience my life with a storm of great proportions so that we can be a part of God's plan for him, because God's plan is bigger than mine. But we need to engage when we're standing on the shore. Don't stand on the shore and look at the wreckage of your life and your lost dreams and your lost plans and all the things you wish you had. Turn around and say, when the time is right, God will send the boat for you. When the time is right, God will get you to where you're going. But right now, he says, will you engage with the people that are standing around you waiting to hear from you? Will you love the people that I love? God loves the Maltese people. He loves them enough to send Paul to them. God loves Fulton enough to send you to them. God loves your parents enough to send you to them. God loves your nieces and nephews enough so that you were saved by grace through faith and now you get to go to them and tell them about it. God loves people so much that he has put storms in your life so that you may be right now standing on the shore of your Malta, and he's asking you to trust him and just engage. Will you and I engage where God has us right now, or will we sit and wait for another boat to come? Yes, I left enough time. Okay, our band's going to come up here. First service, I just obliterated everything. It's too long. We're going to sing a song that I think just kind of captures some of this idea. It's called Oceans. And just the idea is that God, we want God to send us places, and we want God to do things in our lives, but it takes courage, it takes steps, it takes that moment to turn from staring at a broken boat and to walk into town. That takes courage to talk to your friends or family or workers that are around you, employers and friends and guys that you are in sports leagues with, or guys that you hunt with or fish with, or people you've known for 50 years. It takes courage to walk up to them and tell them why you're different and tell them about Jesus. But if we want to be a people that are used by God, if you want to be a part of something powerful, a revival broke out in Malta on this day. Do you see that? Everyone got healed. Everyone heard the gospel. They were so excited. After 3 months, they loaded their boat with everything they could want, everything they needed, and they sent them on their way like conquering heroes. These were prisoners. These were soldiers. These were sailors. These were not the highest ranking people, and yet the people of Malta treated them like they were the highest honored guests. Because God gives us so many amazing things. We can't outgive him. And when we serve him and when we engage for him, he gives us things that we would never even imagine or even think to ask for. Why don't you stand with me? Let's pray. And we're going to sing the song. And I just pray that your heart is just engaged in this message. Because these are not just good stories. Please don't just come to hear a good story on a Sunday morning and to sing some songs. Please, this is about mission. This is about engagement. This is about going out and being a part of what God is doing and seeing that your life matters to him and that God has a plan for you that's bigger than yours. And seeing the storms that are throwing you off course and being like, well, if God has me here, that's where I'm going to be. And that's where I'm going to serve. God, I pray that that would be our heart as a church, that we would not seek to be a church that is just content to sit in rows and to attend, but that we would be a church that wants to be on mission, that wants to be engaged, that wants to be a part of your plan for this area. God, help us to see that you have led us here. You have brought us here. You have placed us here in this place at this time for a reason. And that, God, we would trust you enough to engage with all of our hearts with those people that are around us until the day you call us home or send another boat for us. We want to be a church that makes a difference for you and for your glory, God. Don't let us be just one in a crowd. Don't let us just be a line on a page or a website on the computer, God. We want to be a part of your movement in this area. We want our lives to matter for you, God. We don't want to be content with what we've always known. We want you to lead us somewhere we've never been before, and we want to follow you boldly and courageously. So I pray, God, even now as we sing this song, that it would be truly the cry of our hearts. That we would follow you as your spirit leads us. I thank you for what you're doing here. I thank you for the honor that it is for me to be a part of what you're doing in this church and in this area. I pray, God, that we would catch your vision for this area and we would go after it. Our hope is not in a building. Our hope is not in a vessel. Our hope is in you. I pray that we would pursue that hope until the day you call us home. It's in Jesus' mighty name we pray. Amen.